Big arguments over school funding and more send lawmakers back to Tallahassee this week. After a century in Jacksonville, Jones College is closing its doors. And summer camp is off to a messy start in Duval County. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen there anytime, or on iTunes. Stream us live right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how the city is helping local veterans start or grow their business. Plus, find out where you can bust a move at the ultimate 80s dance party. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome Tessa Duval of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And A.G. Gankarski, the intrepid Florida politics writer. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Lots to discuss this Friday, everything from the closing of a Jacksonville institution, Jones College, to a messy start for local summer camp. But our top story, legislators were hauled back to Tallahassee this week for a special session to try to resolve a number of things like Florida's K through 12 public school budget, economic incentives, and how to implement the rollout of medical marijuana in the state. Last week, Governor Rick Scott formally rejected funding for the next fiscal year that the legislators had passed, saying their budget didn't put enough into K through 12 public education. That remains a major sticking point, along with other big differences like funding for tourism and more. So here's the question. Can our elected leaders come to terms by 6 o'clock tonight? We don't know, but we want your calls. Give us a call as we talk about the biggest stories of the week at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. Of course, lots of discussion about the big national story this week. Jim Comey testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday.
First I heard of it.
And I know a lot of people are still talking about that, but we did want to talk about other big news and notes from the week. AG, let's begin with you. Can legislators get this done by 6 o'clock this evening? They have a lot to try to fix and resolve when it comes to their passing of the budget, public education funding, and more.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, they can get it done. I mean, back channel conversations can move a lot of mountains. They definitely happen in Tallahassee on the leadership level. But you've had a certain amount of entrenchment for the last 6 months or so with the legislature. I mean, the House has had one position on incentives and such. The House is willing to give the governor the money he wants for the incentives, which is great. So now it's kind of the House and Governor Scott on one side and the Senate on the other, which, you know, creates an interesting paradigm. Senate Majority Leader Joe Negron gave a press conference yesterday. He actually got fired up for once, where, you know, he was talking about how there was no secret deal going into the special session. The only thing that looks poised to actually make a deal, ironically, is medical marijuana. It looks like there's some accord there. However, there's a caveat. The amendment that 71% of people voted for last year included smokable marijuana. The legislature, in its infinite wisdom, does not want smokable marijuana. That's a House position. The Senate's fine with that. So you can look for a lawsuit there. So in the annals of special sessions, this one isn't so special so far.
Tessa Duval, it is kind of ironic that, of all things, medical marijuana is the one thing they all seem to kind of agree on.
Yes, and yet we're disagreeing over schools, which is kind of the thing in Florida. You know, school funding is very equitable in Florida, but it's equally low. And so that's why you see these superintendents who are really fired up about this right now.
Claire Goforth, the big controversy this session involved school funding, and in particular, a piece of legislation that traditional public school advocates said would decimate traditional public schools in Florida, that it gave too much to charter schools. I'm simplifying, but, you know, not enough to traditional public schools. Charter school advocates disagreed with that. Rick Scott sent everyone back to Tallahassee and said, we've got to more robustly fund public education. So it seemed as though he heard all of the intense lobbying coming his way from parents, teachers, school superintendents, school board members, and more on this issue.
Yeah, certainly. But it seems as though some in the legislature are listening very closely to the lobbying from the charter school interest. And I mean, there's far from consensus on this. So it's easy to say, and it does seem looking from the outside looking in, that the voters by and large support public schools more prevalently than charter schools. But there are people out there that feel very strongly that charter schools provide students with greater choice and a more tailored education to their needs.
549-2937. And, you know, this is nothing new for the state of Florida. How many times, I can't even remember, what after how many sessions now have they had to go back into special session to kind of tie up a bunch of loose ends?
Yeah, and this is really something we're seeing more of during Republican domination of Tallahassee. And, you know, it points to a larger philosophical debate in the Republican Party. You have the Rick Scott kind of pro-business, let's keep the economic engine moving side. And then you have the side that's more populist saying, why are we giving these companies, you know, incentive money to come in? Why are we, you know, expanding what government does? You know, all of this with caveats, of course, but the fights we're seeing right now are between groups of Republicans, groups of ostensible conservatives. They have a lot of areas in which they overlap and agree, but the areas in which they disagree are the ones that, you know, we're seeing policy debate on, you know, the education issue, medical cannabis issue, budget issue, local projects. A lot of those got vetoed to make room for incentive money. So it's been interesting to watch that, you know, rather than have a smooth running machine in Tallahassee, what you're seeing is three machines pulling in opposite directions.
Yeah, and you know, when you look at how much the House has really dug in on these incentives, and now it seems as though they're just sort of rolling over, and they're going to pass it.
Incentives for Visit Florida, in particular,
Florida.
Yeah.
It does kind of give you the sense that perhaps they're not as powerful as they were trying to make themselves out to be, and in that Rick Scott is getting a lot of what he's wanted.
Tessa.
I am just curious to see what we do by 6 o'clock.
Yeah. Can this get done by 6 o'clock?
Yes.
Can they drop the white handkerchief? Well, do they do that in special session?
Well, they can always extend the session. I mean, there's nothing saying they can't. And that's one possibility. I mean, if we're looking for clean resolution on these big items, it's not likely. But, you know, either they want to get business in or they don't. I mean, they're non-negotiables. The school districts have to figure out their budgeting right now. They are kind of locked in limbo, Duval and others, based on what's happening in Tallahassee. So they need to find resolution. It may not be today, though.
And another one, another line item that hasn't gotten as much attention, UF Health Jacksonville will be affected depending on what they do or don't do in terms of expenditures to reduce the impact of cuts in Medicaid to hospitals around the state. That's something UF Health Jax is watching closely as well.
Yeah, and I mean, if the Trump Care passes, it does seem as though there will be even more people without insurance, which makes hospitals like UF Health, which is a safety net, even more vital to the community, and they may even need more funding next year. So are we going to let them lose this funding and be scrambling to take care of all these people who no longer have any sort of primary care to go to?
Yeah, and if you look at city discussions over the last couple of years, there's been a general need in budget season. We're in budget season now on the city level to actually, you know, put more money into UF Health's kitty from the city. Up the contribution. And, you know, there's been ways to look at things like, you know, changing the revenue stream, like getting the Northside campus going, which actually it is. It's bringing different revenue in and so forth. But the city is going to have to make decisions to dedicate resources to this hospital because, you know, there's obviously the indigent care angle, but there's also the angle of decreasing the burden on the other hospitals in the area. So yet again, you're going to see that during budget season, June in the mayor's office, we're in now, and also, you know, in August and Finance Committee. So you're going to hear those discussions come up.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable here on the show. 549-2937 as we discuss the top stories from the last 5 days and also making headlines this week. This was sad to see. After nearly a century, Jacksonville's Jones College is closing its doors. The school lost its accreditation and will shutter doors by December 31st. As our partner News for Jax reports, some 300 students enrolled there will be transferred to Kaiser University in Jacksonville. Jones College features associate and bachelor's degree programs in a number of fields. and it had been accredited through the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools. Many people over the years interacted with Jones College through Jones College Radio, by the way, which also went away after some 50 years. But this was a sad headline to read. Jones College right there on the banks of the St. Johns River in Arlington.
Also had a campus on Edgewood.
And had, pardon me, yes, it did. Yes.
And that building is actually for sale now.
Yeah.
I believe about $2 million. You know, this is, this was sad. A lot of people have a lot of attachment to this institution to close just shy of 100 years. You know, nobody wants to see something like that happen. But, you know, the entity that accredited Jones College, you know, lost its standing with the Department of Education. And instead of, you know, instead of pursuing other accreditation, I think Jones College just decided it was time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these for-profit colleges, you know, they're dependent on money from military veterans. They call it 10 money in the sector. And basically, they
Jones College is a nonprofit.
Yeah, okay. But, you know, with accreditation like this, it is kind of up in the air. And it is kind of, you know, left open. And when you do depend on revenue streams, and the revenue streams don't materialize, you have financial issues. Like a couple of years ago, they had to sell the radio station. That was not a decision they wanted to make. It was a cash flow situation, and it was an augury of what was to come. You know, when they sold that resource and, you know, took the heat they did for it, you could kind of see the end coming because they're trying to create liquidity. But liquidity for what? Now we see, you know, they just couldn't keep the business model going any longer. And, you know, we're going to head into a wave of these private colleges, whether for-profit, non-profit, or what, they're going to go under because the revenue model is going to change, you know, now that the Obama era is over and Trump's in.
And it's 549-2937. When you look at for-profit universities, as you mentioned, Jones was a non-profit. However, the students are now going to be moved to Kaiser University,
which is for-profit.
Mm-hmm. And InfoLaw, which runs Florida Coastal School of Law in Jacksonville, has had issues with its for-profit law schools in other states, and is in danger of closing its doors in other cities around the country because this model has had a lot of problems.
It certainly has. I mean, their marketing strategies have been brilliant, and it seems like that's really where they've put all of their eggs, and they really have neglected to put them into the faculty and into making sure that the students that they are bringing in and the education they're providing is such that after school, these students are able to get jobs. Because education isn't just something that we pursue because we like to study. We pursue education primarily so that we can be a greater asset to an employer and we can earn higher income. Now, statistically, people with a higher education do earn higher incomes, but with these for-profits and with some of these schools that were dragging along, like it does seem now that Jones College was among, these students graduate and then their degree does not make them anywhere near as marketable as they were led to believe by the marketing materials, and they're left with huge student loan debts and really no economic prospects. They're back working at Walmart like they were before they went to school, and now they have six figures of student loan debt in some cases.
Our own reporter, Ryan Bank, hopping onto the panel. Hey, Ryan, good morning.
You know, I think this is just, you know, a microcosm of a much larger problem. AG kind of alluded to it, Tessa alluded to it, that we have an issue with kind of a crisis of character almost. Like, what is school for? Is school for just education? Is it for, you know, like the classical understanding of a university where you learn and you debate and you become a well-rounded individual? Or is it just a job mill? Is it just a way for you to get that ticket that you need just to compete in the market? And I think a lot of these schools are going to be wrestling with these issues moving forward, and not just for-profit or non-profit small colleges mm-hmm. like this, but we're also going to be looking at our big universities and the types of funding that they get too, our state universities. You're seeing a lot of money being diverted to different programs to reach students. And there's a lot out there. We've seen our own legislators who are really concerned with making our universities just seem more like preeminent and to have that kind of prestige, and a lot less of it is really about educating students.
Let's go to your calls on this now. CJ is in St. Nicholas. Hey, CJ, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to chime in real quick and see what the panel had to think. You know, part of this discussion of colleges, whether for-profit or for public institutions, is also the abundance of the online free colleges like Coursera and edX and Udacity. You're able to access these courses like from places like MIT and Harvard and Stanford for free. And also, you don't have to amass a student debt. Additionally, there is a well-known venture capitalist and industrialist, Peter Thiel, who also will pay, he has a fund, he will pay college students to not go to college and open a business instead. So there's a lot of forces that are they're disrupting the college industry. And but I do believe in robust public institutions and for things like research, for things like, and there should be, as we discussed in the presidential election with Bernie Sanders, I do believe that there should be free vocational and free public school as well. So we should allow students to not have student debt and instead of invest in houses and invest in the economy. So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
All great points. CJ in St. Nicholas, thanks for that. Yeah.
Well, I think it's important to point out there are a lot of options for higher education in Jacksonville. We have UNF, we have JU, we have Edward Waters.
FSCJ, EWC. Yeah.
Edward Waters has had its own struggles with accreditation in the past, but FSCJ, I mean, when people think of getting an associate degree in Jacksonville, FSCJ is the institution that comes to mind.
And they're fighting for funding too, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and people argue that about these for-profit schools and some of these other schools that it does provide an avenue to attain an education for people who may not otherwise have been able to get an education, people who are impoverished or minorities that didn't go to a good high school and really didn't have anyone pushing them to apply to college. So there is an argument there that these schools do give a lifeline to people who may not have otherwise had a way to access higher education.
And that's a lot of what Florida Coastal does for its law students. These are a lot of people who are perhaps mid-career looking to become attorneys, mm-hmm. don't have the option to move to Tallahassee or to Gainesville to pursue that. And they take a lot of people who may not get into those institutions, but still produce some fine attorneys.
Garrett on the north side. Go ahead, Garrett.
Yes, good morning. Regarding K-12 funding, how are public schools funded? Is it like district property taxes or some other like local mechanism? And why does it seem that poorer part of towns have older facilities, older textbooks, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. Yeah. And you know, before our outgoing superintendent, Nicolai Vitti, left, he tried to make the case that we needed a massive infusion of cash to beef up our public school infrastructure in a lot of these older buildings in poorer districts in particular.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and there's a paradox there, though. I mean, you're looking at, if you look at Jackson, Raines, Reball, you've got neighborhoods that are in long-term population decline, long-term decline in the value of the actual property. You know, commercial sectors, they're not at full capacity there. So it's hard to justify with limited resources, you know, pumping in a bunch of resources into these schools that are 60, 70 years old. They might be tear down in some cases, and that's where you got the school consolidation argument that Vitti honestly almost lost his job over, because, you know, he got pressure from Corrine Brown, he got pressure from Brown's allies on the school board, and, you know, he came very close to losing his job for saying, we need to really look at reallocating resources and what that means.
Yeah, she dropped into a meeting unannounced, former Congresswoman Corrine Brown.
Right, this is back when it meant something for her to drop into meetings. That was some time ago.
By the way, we just got a call from a listener. Kaiser University, he wanted to correct us, is nonprofit and fully accredited. So thank you for that. And it's 549-2937. Also this week, other news and notes that have caught the eye of our esteemed panel, A.G. Gankarski. Let's begin with Corrine Brown.
Oof. Corrine Brown, she filed two motions regarding her trial. She was convicted on 18 counts of fraud for One Door for Education, fraudulent charity. The first one, a motion for a new trial because one juror was bounced off because the Holy Spirit apparently was compelling his decisions on the trial. That didn't sit well with the jury, so he got removed. And she's, you know, saying basically that the Holy Spirit is acceptable to guide. There's an acquittal motion also saying that the government did not prove its case, basically reiterating the defense arguments that didn't fly with the first first jury. They're bringing it back again. I don't know if these are going to fly or not. These feel last gasp to me, but I've been surprised by courtrooms before. It's been a tough defense for Brown. She hasn't really had the resources to keep up with the feds, and it's shown in her defense.
Yeah, the second claim on, you know, just throwing out the verdict based on, you know, not meeting the burden of proof, that really is just one of those kitchen sink things. You just throw everything you can at them. But the one on the juror, that is an interesting one. It's not likely that Judge Corrigan, who oversaw the first trial, is going to overturn himself. But if he does not, as I expect, then most likely she will appeal to the Court of Appeal. And if she loses there, she may appeal to the Supreme Court. And this is there's enough of a question there about this Holy Spirit argument. I mean, it's kind of funny, but it actually is a decent legal argument. It could even reach the Supreme Court level.
Wow. Ryan.
I think it raises questions.
Well, I mean, as AG said, you know, this was the second motion that he filed was something that he tried to argue and file motions in the middle of the trial as well, saying that the government hadn't sufficiently proven their case and that everything that they had gathered was sort of circumstantial and that there was no that Brown wasn't caught red-handed necessarily.
Sometimes you have to do that to preserve it for appeal, though.
Well, yeah, but he went through all of those motions and he was denied, I think, just about all of them. He might have been granted one or two of them. I can't remember exactly which ones he was granted, but, you know, that juror number three who was kicked off, I mean, it's kind of gift-wrapped for James Smith, the lawyer of Corrine Brown, because he had nothing to grab onto until she or he was kicked off the jury.
All right. Another headline that caught Tess's eye, summer camp starting Monday, and it's been a bit of a mess lately. Why?
Oh, boy, where do I start? So last Friday, we saw the mayor and many city council members stand up and say that, you know, they were all very surprised that there would be fewer children served in summer camp this upcoming summer because of strategic, planned policy decisions made by the Children's Commission and by the Jack's Journey. Well, the fact of the matter is there was nothing surprising about this. This vote had been a long time coming. It was made in January. People knew what was going on. But when parents hear, oh, my kid doesn't get to go to the same summer camp they've always gone to, well, that's when they start calling their city councilors. So it looks fantastic that this extra nearly $1 million was found. But in reality, nobody should have been surprised by this. Wow. Parents, perhaps, but decision makers, absolutely not.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, they had a positive budget variance anyway as they head toward the end of the fiscal year. So they didn't lose anything doing this. They were going to do something with the money, whether it was sweeping a general fund or this. It was a good hero moment for the mayor. He got to call a press conference, got to have most of council surrounding him up there, talking about how he restored summer camp funding, talking about reforms to the Children's Commission and Jacksonville Journey. As Tessa asked during the press conference, one thing that could happen is these things could be merged. So, you know, look for some restructuring, perhaps coming from the mayor's office. But, you know, this is something that should have been caught on to months before. Why wasn't it? That's the real question. And that's one that we're probably not going to get to today or this year, but it's one that's going to come
back. And one that whomever the gets chosen to lead the JCC in the future, because John Heyman is retired from that position, right? This will be something that the new CEO will have to get their arms around, I take it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but again, it's important to point out there are some things we know and we don't know. And what will the JCC of the future look like? We don't know. It could be one entity with the Jack's Journey. But I mean, there were council members and city leaders and nonprofits who were part of this discussion about why we should pay more per child. And it was with the intent of driving up quality, improving literacy, doing more field trips. This wasn't something that was done. It was a trade-off, and everybody knew it was a difficult trade-off. And when it came right down to it at the last minute, when parents realized what was happening, that's when there was a lot more obvious playing politics that became involved with this.
Now, you mentioned Mayor Curry. He is in D.C. for a big infrastructure summit. This was supposed to be infrastructure week for President Trump. It didn't turn out that way. I mean, officially it is.
Things are crumbling.
But, yeah, I mean, it didn't work out that way for obvious reasons. chief of which is Jim Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. There wasn't any real attention given to the infrastructure summit, but the mayor did go up for it.
Mayor Curry is playing the long game with Donald Trump. Let's not get it twisted, because he's gotten a lot of criticism for being too close to Trump, et cetera, et cetera. We need federal money for a number of things. Jaxport dredging, JTA, other projects that could fall under Trump's infrastructure proposal. And, you know, Curry has defended Trump every step of the way on the campaign trail, after the election, even with his Paris Accord tweet. You know, Curry's like, he's fighting for jobs, American jobs. I mean, that to the media, that sounds ridiculous. But to Donald Trump, that sounds like an ally. And, you know, in a budget where every dollar counts, if we can get more federal money, which didn't really come our way so recently, you know, then it's this trade-off that the mayor is willing to make. And obviously, he's got political ambitions to go beyond City Hall. The question is when, though.
Ryan.
I mean, how is Mayor Curry going to be assured that the Congress works together and actually allocates funds that he wants? I don't think that they're really all in that much agreement. You have a freshman congressman representing the Jacksonville area and the districts that snake through here, and I'm not entirely sure how that gamble plays out. Another thing to watch, and to plug Community Thread, which is our TV program, our quarterly TV program, we're going to be talking about how city funds are distributed and which projects actually get funded. So I think that's another interesting thing. Which one of these projects is Curry really going to push for, and how is it going to help the overall city, not just areas in downtown, not just Jaxport? How is it going to help people on the north side, where, you know, they've been talking about, you know, wanting more funding in infrastructure since the Better Jacksonville plan was released? So there's a lot of questions right now, but his relationship with Donald Trump could be an asset in the future, and I think that that's probably what he's thinking.
Claire. I mean, that's presupposing that Donald Trump is president for the next reasonable length of time. We'll see how that turns out. It's definitely a gamble, because Donald Trump is increasingly politically toxic, allying oneself with Donald Trump on climate change of all things, which the majority of Americans agree is a real problem. And, you know, scientists the world over agree is a very serious issue that we need to face as a world community. Now, we can argue back and forth about whether or not the Paris Accord had teeth in it, and it probably didn't have enough teeth, honestly, but it was a moral standpoint. It was a moral position that we had taken as a nation, and America has so long been at the forefront of ethics and reason.
How about the Cambodia?
You know, I mean, even still, even those issues aside, that is how we are seen. And this is one of those issues that has united people the world over. And when we say, nope, we're going to withdraw from that, we say that we're not standing with you. We're standing apart from you.
Well, there are a few things to remember about that. I don't think, Mayor Curry being an ally to Donald Trump is really going to hurt him that much. It's definitely not going to hurt him with his base. If anything, it's going to shore up his base. And on top of that, I really don't think a lot of people using the I word, but I don't think impeachment is something that's going to happen. We've seen this Congress not really warm up to that idea. So I think Curry is probably safe in this gamble.
2018 isn't that far away.
All right. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida, the Naked Guy edition. Only in Florida do naked guys get busted urinating on a police cruiser. Yes. Sheriff's deputies in Ocala arrested 18-year-old Andrew Humphreys Wednesday when they found him walking down the street completely nude.
18 and life to go.
Makes sense. When they cuffed Humphreys and put him in the back of the patrol car, he started pulling on the metal cage, causing $1,000 in damage. As they were leaving the jail, they found out that Humphreys, before his arrest, had actually damaged another patrol car by pulling off its handle and urinating on it. A way to express his opinion of law enforcement? We don't know.
He may have been upset about the president. Come on.
And only in Florida does a woman let a snake... This one is actually very upsetting. Does a woman let a snake bite her baby as a learning opportunity? A woman in Sebring is under investigation after posting a video on Facebook showing a red rat snake biting her one-year-old daughter.
Classic snake bites infant story you hear all the time.
The woman told a Tampa TV station she has no regrets for introducing the girl to the snake. She has not been charged, interestingly enough, but has deleted the video.
Slithering away from the long arm of the law.
And you can't delete Facebook videos, people.
That's true.
It's out there.
That's right. That's how we even found out about it. Ryan Bank, A.G. Gankarski, Claire Goforth, and Tessa Duvall. Thanks for being here, you guys.
Thank
have
you.
A, have a great weekend. And we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
How is Jacksonville spending our tax money? For years, city leaders have talked about bringing jobs and updating infrastructure to make the city more attractive. But are those investments spread across the city equally? Join our panel of experts and moderator Melissa Ross for a live, interactive, televised discussion on June 29th. To send your questions or to RSVP, go to wjct.org/events. WJCT's Great Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at a fraction of their value, at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. The bidding begins June 15th and continues through June 26th. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, the discovery in Morocco of the oldest known Homo sapiens fossils yet, and the tale that their teeth have to tell.
Teeth are basically fossils in your mouth.
Plus, sunscreen use is on the rise, but so are cases of melanoma. How is that possible? We'll look at the way we use SPF products. They can actually do more harm than good. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a free summit for local veterans who are interested in starting or building a business. The 2017 Jacksonville Vetrapreneur Summit is coming up next Wednesday at FSCJ's Advanced Technology Center in downtown Jacksonville. We're pleased to welcome with a preview Bill Spann, Director of the City of Jacksonville's Military Affairs and Veterans Services. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Kenneth Johnson, also with Military Affairs and Veterans Services.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Jeff Shuford with the local organization Tech from Vets. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
Bill, let's begin with you. This is the city's effort to help veterans get into the business world or grow the business they already have, right?
Absolutely. This is a wonderful opportunity. It's a little different than some of the normal things we do, which is connecting vets with their VA benefits. The last couple of years, we've connected 14,500 with about $51 million in new money from the VA. But this is a great opportunity to come down for those vets who want to start their businesses and sort of get some gouge, as we say in the military.
Right. And Kenneth Johnson, they can plug into resources, subject matter experts, networking, all of that stuff.
All of that is involved with it. And what we want to, what we are presenting, rather, is what we call a real-time access to information and resources. For example, you've got veteran-owned business men and women who are part of our panel of experts. They can share with the attendees the kinds of challenges and opportunities that are out there, you know, the bumps in the road, the economic potholes that they went through to get over in real lifetime.
Because it can be tough transitioning to civilian life.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Now, Jeff Shuford, tell us about your organization, Tech from Vets, and how this is part of the whole summit.
Well, thanks. So Tech from Vets was established last year.
It stands for Technology from Veterans of the Military and Veterans of the NFL. And we've been very fortunate enough to be named the best veteran-owned tech startup of 2016 by the Huffington Post.
Wow.
And that goes back to the ecosystem that the city of Jacksonville, the mayor, has you know, set up for us right now to where we can actually prosper. You know, 45% of veterans are more likely to start a business than people who have not served. So this event is really impactful for us to be able to see the resources, you know, and to engage with veteran-owned businesses who had a level of success in our city.
And what are some of the challenges that veterans have expressed to you, Bill Spann, that you're going to try to help them address at this event as they come back from service and they try to get a job or start a business? There is a series of challenges that I think a lot have in common.
Well, it can be as basic as just writing a resume. I'll use myself as an example. I didn't write my first resume until I was 42 years old. I was coming out of the military.
Wow.
Needed some help. We will help you down at City Hall to write your resume. We'll help you with interview questions. We'll help you with the job search. But this is more specified. This is for that subpopulation of veterans who want to start their own business. I mean, these guys are brave, and it's not easy. You know, everybody knows the stats on starting your own business. And so it's really good, as Kenny said, to be able to pick the minds of the folks who have been there and done that.
And you've got a great panel, it sounds like, of people who've been successful.
Very much so. And that panel was selected specifically to give balance to the program. One, you have veteran business owners who are actually in business, you know, who went through the, you know, travails of getting to where they are. Then you have a panel of resources, information and technical advisors, all talking at the same time. But the uniqueness of this is that we want the attendees to ask questions of the folk who are sitting there, who've experienced it and who met those challenges. And and we're going to kick that off with that kind of push, that kind of involvement from everybody.
Jeff Shuford.
Yeah, you know, theoretically speaking, I mean, Ken just hit it on the head. You know, usually when we go to these programs that are supposed to put us in front of helping us start our business, we're just in front of the resources, right? We're not in front of veteran-owned business owners that have had a level of success in our own ecosystem. So, you know, the Military Affairs and Veterans Department, along with the mayor, has done a really great job of putting all this together for us so we can prosper. And, you know, quite frankly, a lot of times veterans were looked at as if, you know, we want a handout, when this is giving us a hand up to be able to be empowered and to start our own businesses.
And it's coming up next week. Did I mention it's free? This is free, as the city's Military Affairs and Veterans Department, in collaboration with FSCJ, present the 2017 Jacksonville Vetrapreneur Summit from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. next Wednesday. It's at the FSCJ Advanced Technology Center on State Street, which is in downtown Jacksonville. Just go to jacksvetbiz.com, jacksvetbiz.com, to register and attend. And Bill Spann and Kenneth Johnson with the City of Jacksonville, Jeff Shuford of Tech from Vets. Gentlemen, thanks for being here, and I'm sure it'll be a great event.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll be right back.
Wonder Woman's out in theaters. On the next Fresh Air, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. Jill Lepore is the author of a best-selling book about the comic book superhero. The character's creator, William Moulton Marston, was inspired by the women's suffrage movement, feminist Margaret Sanger, and by erotic pinup art. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Fighting does not make you a hero.
What if I promise to be careful? Just a shield, then.
Diana.
No sharp edges.
Be careful of mankind, Diana. They do not deserve you.
Welcome back. Well, a massive opening weekend for the new film Wonder Woman has also seen its share of controversy. Everything from women-only screenings for the hit movie, some guys complained about that, to Israeli star Gal Gadot's positioning in the Arab world. And what does the film say about gender in the modern era? UNF's Nick Michaud occasionally drops into the show with some pop culture philosophy, and he has some thoughts about Wonder Woman. Hey, Nick, good morning.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it's a great film. I'll try not to give away any spoilers.
But this is an interesting film in terms of it's a huge action film with a female star and a female director, and it broke the $100 million mark pretty quickly. That's a big deal for women in Hollywood, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big deal, especially because the director's a woman. This is the first major motion picture for a superhero that has a female director. So it's done some pretty big stuff in that regard.
And what do you think it says about female action heroes, all the gender issues that have come out around this movie? It's really being championed as a female empowerment narrative. But there have been some complaints about that from guys.
Yeah, well, there's definitely pluses and minuses to it. So the film does some really great work in terms of, I think it's actually something we really need right now. Given the socio-political climate, there's been a fair amount of resurgence, I think, of overt sexism. People kind of are feeling a little bit more like, oh, well, we can return a little bit to being able to just say whatever we want. It's our First Amendment right to be able to speak how we want about women. But this film is kind of definitely anti-overt sexism, though there's some criticism insofar as it does actually still kind of emphasize some undercurrents of sexism against women. But at the very least, we have a film where we have this recognition that it isn't the 1950s anymore. And so even if there's this idea that, oh, well, we can kind of go back to grabbing women the way we want, no, we're not going to have it, right? If you touch a woman, she might just haul off and punch you in the face today, right? And so that's definitely, I think, a positive. There's some negatives as well to it, though.
Like what?
Well, so if you watch the film, you realize that there's some things that happen in the film that wouldn't make sense if it was a man doing it in some way. In other words, or we would never put a man in that situation. And so it's that kind of sexism where you go, so there's a moment, and it's funny but deeply problematic, where it's kind of cringeworthy, where Wonder Woman is first coming to the world of, and as they call it in the film, world of men, and she sees a baby and kind of freaks out. And it's like, oh, a baby. And the guy who's with her has to like pull her back a little bit. And I think to myself, wow, that's funny, but I can't see Batman in that position. Like, oh, a baby. You know, and then Robin's like trying to, no, Batman, we have to focus at the task at hand. Right.
And isn't the whole conceit of it that when Wonder Woman goes to London, like turn of the century London, she's never been confronted with sexism before in her Amazon tribe, and then all of a sudden she's treated differently as a girl.
Yes, which again is fantastic, and it deals with some very important like heteronormative issues, the fact that they're all women, and so on and so forth. And on the surface, this is important. Notice, though, that it's kind of like where you realize if you have a film that's primarily a black cast, it's almost always going to be about racism or the civil rights or slavery. And you realize, unfortunately, that if a film has a lead superhero who's a woman, it's in many ways going to be about the fact that she is a woman. But this Amazonian issue, the sad thing a little bit about it is although they are primarily focused on being women, that in that early part of the film, there's still a lot of talk about their responsibility to the world of man, right? That they owe something to men.
There were also controversies over the producers of the film, the studio, holding these women-only screenings around the country. Some men complained about that and said that was discrimination.
Right. And so there's a lot to unpack there.
And Gal Gadot is Israeli.
Right.
In the film's banned in Lebanon.
Yeah.
There's a lot of controversy around that part of it, too. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, well, it is. And especially because one issue that comes up is just a matter of, well, should we simply reply to men who are bothered by this? Well, now you have a sense of kind of how it feels to not be allowed to do a thing, right? But on the other hand, that is still, you know, a kind of sexism. And,
yeah, a lot
and,
of women were, yeah, I know. But weren't a lot of women saying, you know, here's my tiny violin that you were shut out of a screening.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, now, well, you know how women have felt for millennia not having access to things.
Yeah, well, you know, and you look at something like, okay, well, you still get to have like 90% of CEOs are white men who are 6 foot or taller. So I'm not that sad for you. But at the very least, part of what I think we don't entirely understand is how objectified and repressed communities also feel a deep need to be communities because they're not recognized. And so for women to have this opportunity to kind of have women only showings, this is part of this idea of sisterhood and being able to kind of come together and almost kind of actually act out this idea of a kind of Amazonian tribe together, that we are united. And I think that ends up being very important, that right now in a world of kind of resurgent, overt sexism, for a while there was this idea where you would hear women say something like, oh, well, I'm a feminist, but I don't want people to call me like a feminazi or something like that. But now that people are again kind of feeling comfortable with overt sexism and it's our right to be able to say what we want about women, so on and so forth, women can say something like, oh, no, I'm not a feminazi, I'm a Wonder Woman. And I'm not going to put up with it anymore.
Nick Michaud, always fascinating to get inside your brain. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, and one quick thing. My affiliation is now FSCJ.
Oh, and, thank you.
Yeah, and I'd love it if you would check out I have a YouTube show now, You Philosopher. So spelled with a little U and then philosopher.
We will definitely check that out.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. Well, finally this hour, it's the dance party you've dreamed of. Yes.
Yeah, it is.
For the teen trapped in all of us, Apex Theater Studio, in partnership with Ponte Vedra Concert Hall, will present the Ultimate 80s Dance Party Saturday night. Also the kickoff for the Apex Summer Theater Series. Managing Director Ian Mayers, who has often struck me as being like an 80s movie character in real life.
Oh, I'm going to take that as a compliment.
It is. And he joins us now. Hey, Ian Mayers, good morning.
Good morning. I do exist in a John Hughesian universe.
Yes, you do, and it's why I love you so very much.
Now, I heart you too. Big
emoticon. So how did this all come about?
Hey, you know, we spend our summers making sure that the young artists in Jacksonville have a memorable summer. We do 2 musicals, a straight show, 8 summer camps, and we have about 150 young artists. But you know what? Mom and Dad need a night out too.
That's right.
And so we just wanted to create that old-fashioned high school dance atmosphere. And that's what it is. It's a dance, folks. It's not a show.
Will Janet Reno be at the dance party?
Eek! I hope
not. That would be neat, but okay. I don't think she will.
No, I think if not.
You're going to have the restless beat of soundtracks from such classic films as St. Elmo's Fire, The Breakfast Club, Say Anything, 16 Candles, and much, much more. The ultimate 80s playlist.
Yeah, as you list all of those things off, everybody who's listening is having their own set of memories to this music. And you know, music and dance is the way we connect as a community. And Ryan Murphy has done such an amazing job of opening the doors to the St. Augustine Amphitheater and the Concert Hall and making them community centers where people gather and connect. And that's what we want to do with the dance.
And you want people to dress 80s too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Get your mousse out, get your high tops, get your flash dance shirt, go to the thrift store and cut something up, ladies.
That's right.
Do it now.
You're wearing a pink button-down shirt.
I do, and I'm working on making my fake retainer tonight.
What are you going to wear Saturday night?
You have to come. It's
a
mystery. It's
a
mystery,
surprise.
But it is definitely something I found at the thrift store.
Do you have a favorite 80s movie?
Oh, come on, 16 Candles. Because I was a nerd. So
for me, it's a toss-up between that and The Breakfast Club. It's a very hard call. Very tough call.
There's so many actors who just exploded out of 16 Candles. Both of the Cusack kids, Anthony Michael Hall, Molly Ringwald. It's just, it's amazing. And also have to give a little plug for Say Anything.
Honorable mention. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And there may be a boombox there. And our photo op Saturday night may be an iconic Maxell ad. So you might want to make sure that your hair is blow dried.
Just saying. Now, Ian, it comes to this. Finally, this hour, we meet in an abandoned studio. We hear the playback and it seems so long ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
It really does. This song is just for you.
Oh,
I thought and thought.
I'm tearing up.
What is the ultimate 80s song? Actually, this was cut in 1979. But, of course, it was the first video ever played on MTV.
Love it.
And we are a radio station and a TV station. So this makes sense in so many ways. Go to the ultimate 80s dance party Saturday night at the
Air conditioning
at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Full bar and Ian Mayers.
Oh yeah, baby. In his high tops.
Enjoy the music, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.